Hey, you're tuned in to the Verve Podcast live from the heart of Las Vegas, Nevada. Thanks for listening, and viva la Verve!
Of Verve, very fun. And in light of our birthday anniversary, and because today's message a little bit more on the serious side, we're gonna do something a little silly. Anybody grow up watching Pee-wee's Playhouse? Yeah. Remember he would have the word of the day, and if anyone mentioned the word of the day, everyone would just have to start cheering and shouting and clapping like it was a big deal. You hate the Tar Heels and Miami just beat them for the ACC championship, which is what just happened. So here's what we're going to do. What we're going to do is, if I say the word corroborate, I want you guys to go crazy, like something really cool just happened, right? So I would say corroborate, and you would. All right. I don't even know if I will, but if I do, I want you to do that. All right. So anyone ever been called in for jury duty? So, yeah, we love that, right? We want to be, no, we don't. No, we don't. And we don't because we know it's important, that's important, but it just feels like it's irrelevant to my life. It has nothing to do with me. And guess what? Today, you're actually being called in for jury duty. It's a jury duty, a trial in which you're going to have evidence presented over the course of 3 days. And the verdict you come to actually has everything to do with your life. It's actually, I would say, the most critical decision you'll ever make in your life, because in this new 3-week series, we're going to put Jesus on trial. Today, we're going to look at some of the claims of Jesus himself and try to look at some evidence to see, did he really make those claims, and was he legitimate in making those claims? And one thing we're going to see is that amongst all the major religious leaders who ever lived, Jesus is the only one who ever claimed to be God. No one else ever did that. Only Jesus claimed to be God. And so today we're going to ask you to start thinking about what is your attitude towards this outrageous assertion that Jesus made that he was actually God come to earth. This question has incredible implications for your life. And so I would encourage you to approach it with some seriousness and with just an open, unbiased mind. You know, when someone serves on a jury, they're asked to approach the evidence in an unbiased kind of way. And I would encourage you to do the same. So today what we're going to do is look at 4 types of evidence. And then next week we'll look at 2 other types of evidence. And then the last week of the series we'll look at the evidence for the resurrection. But today we're going to look at documentary evidence, psychiatric evidence, physical evidence, and character evidence. And man, we've only got 30 minutes, and there is a ton of evidence. So this is going to be a real kind of very brief flyover with the evidence. But if you want to do more research on your own, I would very strongly encourage you to do that. We have a class we offer that you could come to called Verge, where we look at a lot more evidence than this. And there are some great books that you can look at, including 2 that we have for sale today at the Velcro Bar at our cost. We're not making money or anything, but if you want to dig in more, there's some good books. So let's begin by talking about documentary evidence. And here's what I mean. When you look at a historical figure, whether it be Jesus or George Washington or Plato or Aristotle, what you need to do is look at the historical documents from that person's life that describe who that person was and what they said and what they did to try to determine who they really were. And in this case, the historical documents that we're going to look at and talk about are collectively known as the New Testament of the Bible. And so the question that you have to ask is the New Testament accurate in recording the life of Jesus? Is what the New Testament says actually what was originally written, and is it an accurate representation of what actually happened? And so to do that, historians have developed some tests. And these are tests that they use with any ancient document. And so we should apply them to the New Testament. Now, I will tell you that personally, I believe that the Bible is actually the inspired word of God. But we're not going to assume that. Okay? We're going to apply the same test that we would use for any ancient document to try and determine whether it's reliable or not. So the first test is called the bibliographical test. And that deals with the question, do our current copies of this ancient document actually represent what was originally written? Okay, so way back when, somebody wrote something, and then today we have something, but is what we have today what that person actually wrote, or has it kind of been changed through the centuries and that kind of thing? And because we never have with ancient documents the actual first, you know, handwritten copy of the person, what we do, what historians will do, is they'll look at the copied manuscripts that we have. And so this person wrote it down. There was no Xerox machine. So somebody else would copy it and give it to somebody, and somebody else would copy it. And so they look at how many ancient copies, manuscripts, do we have from that ancient document, and how close are they in time to when the original document was written. So, for example, Aristotle and Plato. We don't have the original writings in their handwriting that they wrote, but what we do have is like 20 to 30 ancient copies of each of their writings. Okay, 20 to 30. And because we have 20 to 30, historians have no trouble saying, yeah, what we have is accurate. Because we have 20 to 30 different versions to compare, and so we can see it. If they were all completely, you know, radically different from each other, we could be like, oh, somebody's not telling the truth here, because this is not, but they're all incredibly similar, so, man, it must be that what we have is what was really written. Like, if you were a philosophy major in college, like I was, which is a lot of fun, all kinds of, like, really partying girls in philosophy class. Great jobs you can get, like when you graduate with a philosophy degree. But if you were a philosophy major, you learned all about Aristotle and Plato, and no professor ever said, by the way, we only have like 20 to 30 ancient like copies of manuscripts. And we're not really sure about that. No, they never said that. They're like, yeah, this is what he wrote. Because we know, we're sure, we have 20 to 30. Well, with the New Testament, we're not talking 20 to 30 manuscripts. With the New Testament, what we actually have are over 5,600 ancient manuscript copies that have been unearthed over the years. Over 5,600. And unlike the copies we have of Plato and Aristotle's writings, which the earliest we have are from a few centuries after Aristotle and Plato originally wrote, with the New Testament, we have copies from just a couple of decades after they originally wrote. And not only that, but another way that historians will piece this all together is looking at quotations from those original documents. So you have the original document, but then you have other people start quoting it. And in the first and second century, we have so many quotations from the New Testament, from other historical writers, that you can basically put the entire New Testament together. So even if we were to lose the 5,600 plus copies of the New Testament that we have of the manuscript copies, still we could piece it all together from the quotations. And so with all that, man, we can feel really confident, more confident than any other writing from antiquity, that what we have is what was originally written. Now, that doesn't mean it's true, right? That doesn't mean that what's in here is true, the claims it makes are true. What it means is what we have today is what they actually wrote way back when. Make sense? Hopefully it doesn't. If it doesn't, I'm going to keep going. So it doesn't really matter if it doesn't make sense, because I'm going to keep going, all right? So the second test that that historians will apply to an ancient document is called the internal test, an internal test. And in the internal test, they'll ask a variety of questions. One of the questions they ask is, does this document, this person who wrote it, do they claim to be telling real history? Because sometimes people are writing stories, sometimes they're writing fables or myths. Does it claim to be real history? And it's interesting, throughout the New Testament, over and over, repeatedly, that is the claim that the writers make. Like this guy named Luke, who wrote the book of Luke and Acts, what he says is that he considered himself a historian, and historians today consider him a historian, and he was not an eyewitness, but he went out and interviewed all kinds of eyewitnesses at the time so he could write exactly what happened. And then Paul writes a lot of the New Testament, and he says, hey, listen, what I'm writing about didn't happen in a corner. He says, this isn't something that, like, yeah, I saw, but he's like, this happened, all these things happened in front of eyewitnesses, and so check it out. And then Peter, he says, what I'm writing about is not like a cleverly devised fable or myth. He says, this is an eyewitness account of what actually happened. And so the New Testament claims to be an actual historical recording of actual events. There are other questions that are asked in the internal test, like, well, are there contradictions within this text that might cause us to doubt it? And that's one of the things we really cover in our class called Verge. And so if you have questions like that, man, that's actually one of my favorite parts of Verge is looking at the supposed contradictions. So take that class. You can sign up today. It's coming in April. It's on Sunday nights, six Sunday nights in a row. But we talk about that. But all together, you say, man, the New Testament passes the internal test. A third test is called the external test. And with the external test, historians are asking, so how well does this document that we have, so this document, how well does it square with what we know to be true from history and archaeology? Okay, and so are there things in it that you go, wait a second, it says this, but we know this, and that contradicts, or is it supported by history and archaeology? And so, for instance, history. Next week, you need to be here, because this is something that a lot of people don't know, but next week what we're going to do is we're going to look at most of the at least 39 ancient sources from around the time, from the time of Jesus, and right around the time of Jesus, who wrote about Jesus but aren't in the Bible. So a lot of people think that Jesus is this guy who exists in the Bible. Like if there was no Bible, there'd be no Jesus. No, there are lots of people from the time of Jesus who are writing about Jesus, which you'd hope and expect, right? Like if somebody goes around claiming to be God and doing incredible things, it's not just going to be in one book. And there are at least 39 other people from the time of Jesus who wrote about him and include over 110 facts that we have in the Bible about Jesus. And so they write about his teachings. They write about his life. They write about his crucifixion. They write about his resurrection. And so this isn't just something like that a few people are like, hey, let's get together and write a Bible and make people believe this. I mean, other people, and some of those, at least 17 of those 39 authors were not Christians. They weren't people who were trying to get people to believe this. They were just historians who were writing what happened. And so there are key elements of the New Testament documents that are authenticated and corroborated. All right. From writings outside the Bible. Not all of you participated, I see. Okay, you're not into this whole Pee-wee's Playhouse thing? All right. Some of you came in late and you're like, what just happened? So then we have archaeology, and it's another fun thing, I think, but archaeology has repeatedly confirmed the New Testament writings. In our Verge class, we provide a bunch of examples, and you should totally take that class, but let me give you just like two examples that we don't talk about in Verge. In Verge, I say, man, there's so many, I wish I had more time, so here's two more. So for instance, in the gospel accounts of Jesus' life, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we have descriptions of the trials he went through before he was crucified, okay? Those happened around like the late 20s, early 30s AD. In the book of Acts in the New Testament, we have described for us trials that this guy named Paul went through, and those would have happened in the 50s AD, okay? Well, in a pretty recent archaeological dig, it was discovered that in 50 AD, just some really minute details of how trials were conducted were changed. Just some laws were changed, and so they started doing trials just barely different, like the order of trials. But when this was discovered, some non-believing archaeologists went, oh, we got them. But because there are trials in the Bible from before 50 AD, and there are trials after, and if those documents were accurate, and if they were really written at the time, well, they would have described it, and we'd see those differences. But if they weren't, if they were written hundreds of years later, but you know, by somebody just trying to make up a story, they wouldn't have known that that law was changed in 50 AD. And so they went to the Bible, and they looked at the order of the trials, and they realized they got it right. And once again, archaeology actually confirmed that, man, the New Testament writings are accurate and it's actual history. Here's another example. So in John chapter 5, there's a story about Jesus healing this person who can't walk at a place called the Pool of Bethesda in Jerusalem. And it describes the pool. There's these five big pillars around this pool. Problem. There's been all kinds of excavations of Jerusalem, and there's never been any Pool of Bethesda or these five pillars found. And so for a long time, historians and archaeologists laughed at people who believed the Bible and said, really, you believe that? Have you read John chapter 5? There's no Pool of Bethesda. There's no pillars. Like this is crap. Until not too long ago, they were doing yet another archaeological dig, and there is the Pool of Bethesda, five big pillars around it. You can go to it today. I've stood right next to it. And once again, archaeology actually confirmed the historical reliability of the Bible. There's an archaeological expert named Nelson Block And he says, it may be categorically stated that no archaeological discovery has ever controverted a biblical reference. It's like, we've never found anything that made the Bible look like it was wrong. And so this first test is this documentary test. Are the documents we have that make up the New Testament, are they accurate? And these three tests, the bibliographical test, the internal test, the external test, and there's a lot more that we could say, give us really good reason to believe, man, what we have today is what was actually written back then. So now that we understand that, we can ask this question, well, then what do the documents say? Like, for instance, what did they say about the person of Jesus, about the claims that Jesus made about himself? For instance, did Jesus really claim to be God? There are lots of people today who will say, maybe you've said this, maybe you've heard this, people say, I don't think Jesus ever really claimed to be God. Well, like, I just don't think that happened. But the reliable historical documents we have tell us that he did. He did repeatedly. And the people who lived amongst him and like the religious leaders of the time, they all very clearly understood that this guy is claiming to be God. Let me show you just one example of this in John chapter 10. So if you have a Bible with you, you can turn to John 10. If you don't have one, we'll put the verse on the screen, so no problem. If you don't own one, we'd love to give you one as a free gift today. So on your way out, there's a stack of Bibles at the Velcro bar, which is our connecting place. Get it, Velcro. And that's my Velcro noise right there. Hey. And so you can grab a Bible. It's yours to keep. You don't have to, if you're like, I don't want to meet anybody, I don't want to give you my information, you don't have to just grab a Bible. So John chapter 10, the context is Jesus is talking, religious leaders are getting upset, and they're like, will you just plainly, clearly tell us, who are you saying you are? Okay? And so Jesus talks for a little while, and he ends by saying this, verse 30. He says, I and the Father are one. So Jesus is saying, I and God, same thing. And if you study that word one in the original language, it means one in essence or one in nature. So he's like, I am God. And you might say, well, are you sure, Vince, that that's what... Well, yeah, because of the reaction of the religious leaders. They were very clear in what he was saying, because look what happens. Verse 31, again, his Jewish opponents picked up stones to stone him. Let me just pause there and tell you what that means, because you might think they picked up, they're going to stone him, so like they're going out with like a dude behind the building to stone, no, not that kind of stone, right? Okay, not that. Or you might think, so like what did they, like just take some rocks and throw them, you stop it and hit him with some rocks, no, not that. What they would do is they would put a person against a wall, or they would bury a person up to their neck, so just your head was exposed, and they would take big rocks and kill you with them. They would stone you to death, okay? So that's what they're preparing to do. They're going to grab Jesus, put him against the wall, or grab Jesus and put him, bury him to his neck and stone him to death. And verse 32, but Jesus said to them, I have shown you many good works from the Father. For which of these do you stone me? Verse 33, listen, we are not stoning you for any good work, they replied, but for blasphemy, because you, a mere man, claim to be God. See, sometimes people today will say, I don't think Jesus ever really claimed to be God, but he did. And the people back then were very clear. They understood he is claiming to be God. In fact, this is the reason Jesus is crucified. That's the charge against him is blasphemy. He claimed to be God. I mentioned earlier, no other major religious leader ever made this claim. Okay, Buddha did not. Muhammad did not. Joseph Smith did not. Only Jesus made the claim that he is God. And I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but when somebody says that they're God, and they mean it, not like a joke or something like, I truly think I am God, that leaves you with only three options. Just three options. That person either is telling the truth and is God, that's an option, or they know that they're not God and they're lying to you, in which case the person is a liar, they're kind of evil for trying to get you to think they're God, or the person really does believe they're God, they're just not, and so they're crazy, right? Like they're kind of a Looney Tunes on the level of someone who thinks I'm a watermelon or I'm a poached egg, right? I mean, like, that's, it's pretty crazy if you really think you're God, right? And so, you know, people today will say, I don't think Jesus ever claimed to be God. Like I know Jesus really lived. I just think of Jesus as a good teacher. I think Jesus was a good man. I think Jesus was a very moral person. I think Jesus, maybe some people say, was like a prophet. Like he spoke for God. You can't say that. Jesus took that option away from you. When someone claims to be God, like good teachers don't claim to be God, right? Good moral people don't claim to be God. Prophets of God don't claim to be God. When you claim to be God, there's only three options left. You're Lord, you're a liar, or you're a lunatic. And those options kind of lead us to look at a second type of evidence I want to just briefly think about, which is psychiatric evidence. Because we need to ask the question. There's three options. Let's look at them, right? Let's kind of put that on trial. So is it possible that Jesus was lying? You know, that Jesus was intentionally deceiving his audience. He knew he wasn't God, but he was trying to get people to think that he was. And it's a pretty big lie because he didn't just say he was God, but he actually taught people that their eternal destinies rested, hinged on whether or not they believed his claim to be God. Right? Like, for instance, there's lots of places where Jesus says this, but in John chapter 8, verse 24, when you study the life of Jesus, one of the things you realize is most compassionate person ever, most loving person ever. But at the same time, he says some things that you're like, okay, like I mean, he's serious. You realize he's serious. So look at verse 24, John 8, 24. He says, I told you that you would die in your sins if you do not believe that I am he. You will indeed die in your sins. And so he's saying, what everyone does is sin, we all do. And what everyone needs is to be forgiven. That puts us right with God. And he's saying, the only way you can be forgiven is if you believe that I am God. So he's going around, not just claiming to be God, but telling everyone, your only chance at heaven, your only chance to be forgiven is if you believe who I claim I am. Okay? So if he's lying, I'm going to vote that Jesus was the most evil person ever. That's a pretty big lie, right? When you tell everybody, put your faith in me or you don't go to heaven, and that's not just a lie. And so if he's a liar, he's the most evil, manipulative liar of all time. And so you need to bring that to court. And when you do, if you study the life of Jesus, then there's no way. I mean, Jesus was the most loving and honest person. Like, it just go the idea that he would lie about anything, and certainly the biggest, most evil, destructive lie of all time, goes against everything we know about who he was, about his life and his character. It just does not make sense, his teachings. Not only that, but you'd have to ask the question, who would be willing to be tortured to death for a lie? I mean, that's crazy. If he just made it up, well, don't you think in the moments before they start beating him and then putting stakes through his hands and feet to crucify him, don't you think he might go, I recant. whoa, you know, stop. Hey. It was a lie. I had this evil plan. But it didn't work. About to die. You know, but he didn't. He's like, yeah, I'll die for the claim. If I'm on trial for being God, kill me. Who would die for a lie? So it just doesn't stand up. This idea that maybe Jesus was this evil, horrible, hideous, manipulative liar doesn't hold up. But there's another option. Maybe he was a lunatic. Maybe Jesus really thought he was God. He just wasn't. I mean, right now, if we went to New York City, I bet you we could find 5 or 10 people on the streets of New York City claiming to be God, right? With signs up or, you know, whatever. And maybe even here in Las Vegas, we might be able to find one or two. And so maybe Jesus was one of those guys. Maybe he was honestly convinced he was God. He just wasn't. And if he claimed to be God and thought he was God but wasn't, then he was obviously very mentally unbalanced, right? For a person to be so delusional, they actually think they're God in the flesh. Like, I mean, you're really crazy. And so let's look at that. A little bit more psychiatric evidence. So there is a clinical psychologist named Dr. Gary Collins. He got his PhD at Purdue University. He's been teaching on the university level clinical psychology for 20 or 30 years. And he was asked to study the life of Jesus and determine, is it possible that Jesus was just one of those delusional people who thinks he's God? And so he looks at it and he says, now, people who are delusional in that way, who think they're God, that's not the only way you're going to see it. Someone who is that mentally imbalanced, you're going to see that come out in their life in all kinds of ways. So he says, for instance, emotionally, you're going to see the person kind of have inappropriate emotions. It might be inappropriate depression, or they're just inappropriate angrily, or they're plagued by anxiety. And he says, we don't see any of that in Jesus. He says another sign of mental unbalance is that this person will have misperceptions about the world. It's not just that they're deceived about themselves, like they might think everyone's out to get them, or they might think that people are doing things that they're not doing. They just have all these misperceptions. He's like, we don't see that in Jesus. Also, people with this kind of psychological problems, they'll have thinking disorders. Like, they can't carry on logical conversations with other people. You know, they jump to faulty conclusions. They show irrational behavior and thinking. And he's like, we don't see any of that in Jesus. And he says, you'll also always, with someone who is this delusional, you'll see inappropriate behavior. They'll just do things that are, like, very socially unacceptable, or they might be violent or suicidal and just very socially inappropriate. He's like, we don't see any of that in Jesus. And Dr. Collins came to the conclusion, he says, there's no way you can claim that Jesus was insane. There was another psychiatrist who was asked to do the same thing, and his conclusion was, after studying the life of Jesus, he's like, actually, I believe that Jesus was probably the most sane person who ever lived. So it really doesn't make sense to come to this second conclusion. Maybe he's just a lunatic. And again, that leaves us only one option. If you claim to be God, there's only three choices. You're either lying, you're a lunatic, or you are who you claim to be. You're the Lord. Well, let's look at one more type of evidence. So we've looked at documentary evidence. We've looked at psychiatric evidence. Let's talk a little bit about physical evidence. Because if Jesus really was God, you would expect him to be able to do some things that other people can't do, right? Like if God came down, put flesh on, lived as a human being, you'd say he'd probably have some power, right? He might be able to do some miracles. And so is that true, Jesus? Because if not, why not? But it is. Like, I think you would expect if Jesus were God that he'd have power over nature. And we see that happen. And Jesus walks on water and he calms storms. He feeds thousands of people with some kid's happy meal. I mean, like it's like, wow, he had power over nature. And I'd expect that from God. You'd also think that if he was God, he might have the power to heal people. They'd get sick, he'd be able to heal them. And we see Jesus do that on a variety of occasions. You might assume if he was God, he'd have power over death. And there's this one time where Jesus' friend Lazarus dies. He's in the grave for 4 days. Jesus calls him, and he comes out of the grave. There's several other occasions Jesus brings people back from death to life. And then in kind of the ultimate, like, authentication of this, Jesus himself shows power over death when he dies and 3 days later rises from the dead. And so the miracles of Jesus provide just amazing corroboration. See, that was even worse than the last time. All right. Not a good idea? No? All right, we'll see. Amazing corroboration. Don't do it. Thanks. That Jesus really was who he claimed to be. And Jesus said this, like he told us this. So in John chapter 10, that same chapter where they're all trying to figure out, who are you? What are you claiming? He says to them in verses 37 through 39, put on the screen. He says, do not believe me unless I do the works of my Father. But if I do them, even though you do not believe me, believe the works, that you may know and understand that the Father is in me and I in the Father. Again, they tried to seize him, but he escaped their grasp. And so he's saying, listen, even if you don't believe what I'm telling you I'm God, but even if you can't believe it, just look at my life. Who else can make a storm stop and heal sick people and bring people from death to life? I'm proving it, and so believe the miracles. Now, some of you may be asking this question. I probably would. Whoa, hold on. Like, aren't miracles impossible? Like, I mean, they contradict science. They contradict nature. No, they don't contradict science. Science gives us a set of laws that tell us how things normally work, and a miracle is when God overrides a law of nature for a specific purpose. So, for instance, think of it this way. Let's say there's an apple tree. There's an apple about to fall out of the tree. The laws of nature, the laws of science would say that apple will fall and hit the ground. But you could intervene and stick out your hand and grab the apple, right? And so if you did that, would that mean that the law of gravity is not true? No. Would it mean that you just contradicted science? No, it just means, yeah, that law is true, but you intervene in a way that, in this case, didn't allow for what normally happens to happen. And if there is a God, well, if there is a God, then certainly he could intervene, like we can with an apple falling on a tree. He could intervene, and he could do something that kind of goes against what normally happens if he had a reason to do so. Right? And in fact, he can do that because, I mean, those laws of nature and science, he created them in the first place. So miracles don't contradict science. They just help us to see that the person who's able to do those miracles has the power of God. And in this case, it's Jesus. And Jesus has the power to do miracles, which just makes you think, that is what I would expect. If God came down and was a person, I'd expect that. And Jesus does that. Let's look at one last type of evidence, what I'm going to call character evidence. You know, just like if Jesus were truly God, you'd think he'd have some physical abilities that we don't have. In the same way, if Jesus were truly God, I think there's some character traits we would expect to see in someone who was God, right? Like, for instance, I think we would expect for God to be able to live a perfect life. Like, you and I can't do that, right? Like, none of us can get through life without screwing up. I can't get through a day, you know, without screwing up. We just can't. But I think we would expect that God could, and that's exactly what we see of Jesus. He lives a perfect life. And in fact, it's interesting. So Jesus' enemies, like, at his trial, can't find anything he's done wrong. Pontius Pilate, who's in charge of his trial, says, "I find no sin in this man." And that's interesting, but what's really interesting to me is that the people who are closest to Jesus said he never sinned. Think about that. Like, if you want to know what's wrong with me, ask my wife, right? Like you guys might think, yeah, Vince seems like he's awesome, perfect. No, I'm not. Ask my wife. She lives with me. She can tell you all kinds of problems that I have, right? Well, Jesus spent 3 years, basically every day, all day, with these 12 guys. And so, if you ever go, like, to a camp for a week with somebody, by the end of the week, you're like, oh, boy, right? Like, 7 days, you're like, I could tell you all kinds of problems with that person. These guys spent 3 years every day with Jesus, and they said he had no sin. Like, two of his best friends were John and Peter. John wrote in 1 John chapter 3, verse 5, I'll put it on the screen. He says, in him, in Jesus, is no sin. It's like, the guy never sinned. And then in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 22, Peter says, he committed no sin and no deceit was found in his mouth. He's like, he never did anything wrong. He never said anything wrong. Jesus lived a perfect life, just like you'd expect God to be able to do. And we can think about other attributes of God. You know, like, what else might be true of God if God lived as a person? Like omnipotence, you know, having more power than people have. Jesus had that. Omniscience, knowing things that people just can't know, you know, being all-knowing, Jesus had that. Existing from all eternity, that's the way the Bible describes Jesus, never changing in character. There's just all kinds of things that we find in these historical documents that make us say, man, Jesus fulfills everything you'd expect if God were to come to earth and live as a man. I mean, Jesus just was clearly the most amazing person to ever walk the face of this planet. Really, like, time itself is divided in two according to his birth, right? B.C. and A.D. Every time you write the date, you are confirming the fact that Jesus Christ was an actual person who had such an impact on history, it got divided in half by him. And it's interesting, Jesus never traveled more than 200 miles from his birthplace, and yet he has radically changed people's lives all across the globe. How do you explain that? Jesus never went to college. He never held a degree. But in the Bible, Jesus gives us a way of life. He gives us wisdom that just transcends anything a person could come up with. It's interesting. Even like the people we consider like incredibly wise from more recent times, like Abraham Lincoln or like Gandhi or like Martin Luther King, those people say, my wisdom comes from Jesus. Like, they don't even claim to have wisdom. They're like, I don't have wisdom. I mean, Gandhi, all of them. I got my wisdom from Jesus. Even though Jesus possessed incredible power, you never see him act arrogantly. So, you know, when people have power, just he never got puffed up. He was just humble. He demonstrated amazing compassion for people. Even the Roman soldiers who drove the stakes into his hands and feet. The bottom line is, I think you have to ask yourself with this character question is, what would I expect from God if God were to come to earth? And I think you find that the character evidence is corroboration. We're done with that. All right. That Jesus really was who he claimed to be. He was God in the flesh, Son of God, Savior of the world. So, if you ask me, we've already started to build a compelling case. Again, I got 30 minutes here, and there's so much evidence. Like there are like 13-week classes on evidence that last, you know, like 6 hours of class time a week. And so I gave you 30 minutes. And we're going to get into more evidence over the next 2 weeks. Next week, we're going to look at testimonies about Jesus. But check this. You think, yeah, sure, what did people in the Bible say about Jesus? What we're going to do is we're going to look at testimonies about Jesus from before Jesus was born. That's weird, right? Like you know, if you want to talk to people about what Vince is like, you can't ask people who, like, lived before I ever lived, but you can with Jesus. And we're going to look at testimonies from outside the Bible. I mentioned to you earlier that there are all kinds of people writing about Jesus at the time of Jesus that aren't in the Bible. And so next week, we're going to look at what did those people say about Jesus. And then the following week, we're going to look at the most convincing evidence of all, evidence for the resurrection. I mean, that's really what it comes down to is, did Jesus actually rise from the dead? And so we'll look at evidence for that. But I think we've already started to build a convincing case. And I'll tell you this, you take it all together, and this is a case I would like base my life on. I would actually bank my eternity on it. And I have. And you don't have to come to your conclusion yet, because we'll talk for the next 2 weeks, and if you take our class, Verge, you can learn more if you want, a lot more. There's some good books back there. But ultimately, you have to come to a verdict in this case. You don't have to today, but ultimately, you need to, because Jesus didn't really leave you any other choice. You have to make your decision what you're going to do with him, because Jesus is the one who came down from heaven and said, I love you. And the love I have for you is the perfect and unconditional love that you have been yearning for your entire life. What you really want is just to be loved for who you are. And that's what I want to do for you. And I want to have a relationship with you. I want to walk with you through life. And I died so that you don't have to have your sins attached to you anymore, so that you can be wiped clean, so that you can feel free. And you can feel like the guilt and shame move away, and you can be brought into a relationship with God, and someday I will bring you, Jesus says, into heaven, where you can be with him forever. And ultimately, you have to decide, what am I going to do with that? Will I say yes to Jesus? So, we're going to give you a couple minutes to wrestle with all that. And again, you don't have to come to your verdict today, but we want you to think about it. I know I have problems. I don't know about you, but when I leave this place, I'm thinking about lunch. I'm thinking today about basketball. And so it's real hard for me to take what we experienced here and apply it to my life, because I'm already on to the next thing. So one of the things we like to do is give you a few minutes just to think before you leave, to say, hey, take 3 or 4 minutes and think, what are you going to do with this? So our band's going to play a song. It's not going to be like weird and quiet. So we'll have some music going, and you can listen to the song, but you might want to just take this time to think, what do I do with this? Maybe you're someone who believes, and today you're just like, man, it's nice to know that there's reason to believe. It's not just because I was brought up Christian or my parents believe, you know, but like, there's evidence for this. I can have like an intelligent faith. Maybe you're someone who doesn't believe, and maybe you need to start wrestling with, why don't I believe? And maybe there's more reason to believe than not to believe. And why would I say no to an offer like the one Jesus is making to me? So we're going to give you a couple minutes. Band's going to play a song, and then when that's over, we got like another minute or two, and we're done. Let me pray for you, and then we'll give you that chance. God, I just thank you for Jesus. 3 years of really cool things happening here at this church, and it's all because of Jesus. And the thing that we have going for us is Jesus, and knowing Jesus has completely changed my life. God, my prayer is that we would all know Jesus, and not just in an intellectual way, but in a personal way. And so I am so grateful, God, that you gave us all this evidence, evidence we talked about today. There's volumes of evidence we haven't gotten the time to talk about today, but evidence so that we don't just have to have this blind faith and, you know, kind of this wishful thinking kind of deal that it might be nice if it's true, so I'll believe it, but that we can rest our faith on grounded, reliable reasons to believe. Thank you for respecting our intelligence like that, God. And thank you for Jesus. God, during this time we have communion available, which is bread and juice, and it's a chance to remember that Jesus gave his life for us on the cross, and that what he did for us on the cross can put us into a relationship with you, that he died so that we might live. And so, God, for those of us who are going to take communion during this next song, would you help us just to be grateful for what Jesus did for us? God, I pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.